It is week 17 of the year 2021, and you're listening to Father Roderick to the Max. Welcome back, and thank you for listening. But more importantly, thank you for supporting my work and helping me realize these programs that I want to bring to you, first and foremost, and then to the rest of the world as well. Speaking of which, I just listened to a fascinating podcast, an NPR podcast, which is called How It Is Done or something like that. How I Built This with Guy Raz, a very familiar voice, an NPR voice that I knew from other podcasts. And I just, at one point, I lost him. I think he used to be the host of a show that I would listen to. And then someone else took over. And I wondered, well, where did he go? Well, this is where he went. He does this series where he interviews people that have started a business or are successful writers, YouTubers, you name it. And then he has an hour long, well, actually it feels like an hour. Sometimes it is an hour. Sometimes it's just half an hour where he interviews people and picks their brain on how they built that. And I got a tip from my friend Cliff Ravenscraft, who said, you know, I just listened to this show, this interview with Rick Steves. I think he's called Rick Steves with an S. And he is a very popular travel vlogger, you could say. Although I think he also has a number of television programs that he's been doing for years. He writes books and he loves to travel through Europe. And he built a business around it, which is hugely successful. He's got a tremendous amount of followers and people that watch his programs. But, and this is the interesting part of the interview, that is not his core business. And I mean business in terms of how he makes his living. That is not through his programs. He actually says, I give away my TV show for free. I produce it in a very high quality, and then I just ask the various stations, would you like to air my show? And I don't have to be paid for it. And of course, everybody wants to air his show. Now, how does he make money? This is the interesting part of it. He organizes trips. He's basically a travel agent, and what he has accomplished is by making all these programs and writing these books, he has built up a relationship with his audience. And so if he proposes to his audience to come and join him for a trip through Europe, it could be any country over here, and he will be their guide, then there are so many people that love to do that. And that is how he has created an income. And nowadays he's so famous and it works so well that he has an entire company working for him. I think before Corona, he had 100 people working full time for him to, you know, on this whole enterprise of providing people with unforgettable experiences while traveling. And Cliff said, you know, you might want to listen to this because it could give you some ideas on where to go from here. And you know that I've been sharing this, that I constantly have to live with this possible threat that my TV show will be canceled. And every year it's the same discussion. We don't know if we're going to give you another contract for after the summer. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. Maybe it's going to be another program. And so for years I've been living with this idea, well what if this is the end of my TV show and I have to, I can no longer rely on that on TV for to reach an audience and also to make a living and to be able to pay my bills because, well, I have to pay for my own sustenance. And while listening to this interview with Rick Steves, I indeed got a few ideas. Especially what I loved was this idea of giving away your TV content for free. He said, actually, it's very hard to make any money in TV right now, which kind of surprised me because I always thought of, especially TV in North America, as, you know, big business. They could probably only laugh about the kind of budget that I have to work with on Dutch TV. But it turns out that a lot of the TV in the US is public TV. and they have to do fund drives to keep it going. And so they're always struggling to make ends meet in order to continue. And the whole fundraising is such an integral part of what they do during the year. And I've seen that also with NPR and some of these other local stations that do these fund drives for weeks. And it's like, ugh. I never realized how important it was for them to actually continue doing what they did. Now, I had a little bit of experience with fundraising when I was working for SQPN, but since I started Tridio, I really never did a fund drive or anything. Not that I recall. I have the Patreon system, which I like personally very much because it's basically not begging people for money, so please give me money so I can pay for this or that. But it is, you know, help me realize my dreams. Help me bring you these programs and help me to improve them so you will enjoy them even more. So you get stakeholders instead of just, charitable donors. And of course, many of you are very charitable. But what I hope is that my supporters feel that they are building this, what I do with me. And so I want you to feel part of the adventure and have this feeling that it's not just Father Roderick wants to do something and he needs money for that, but we want to do something. And Father Roderick is able to film and he's, maybe the face of this, but we're doing this as a community. That is why I always stress how much I consider Patreon to be a community. That's why I'm so happy with Discord, where you truly feel more and more that we are a club, basically, of people that start to know each other. We start to exchange all these stories and photos from our kitchen and whatnot. I love that. Prayers, intentions, all that. That has always been my dream that one day we can grow this apostolate almost as a digital parish, like a church. Isn't this what a church is supposed to be? It's a group of friends that are working together to spread the gospel. So from this interview with Rick Steves, I got the idea of, well, what if I would do that? What if I would continue to make documentaries in the same way I do them now, but I would no longer be constricted to what the broadcasting company wants me to do and it always has to be in the Netherlands, etc. And that's normal because they're paying for it. And the show, the end result, becomes their property. I lose all my rights to the end product. That used to be the case with Rick Steves as well. And he said, you know what? I didn't have a choice. I didn't know how to make a TV show. But I needed to pay the bills. I had a family and I had to feed my children. So that's why I did it. But I gave away everything I did. And of course I got some money in return, but I gave away what was much more important was my way of looking at Europe. That's why his new show is called, or relatively new show, is called Rick Steves Europe. It is Europe unlike any other travel agency or unlike any other documentary maker. It's his Europe. It's his take. And he makes it super personal, which I think is very modern. He says, I was writing these guides for visiting, I don't know, Italy or other countries in Europe. And I would just give my own list of favorite places to visit. And maybe I didn't say anything about the big tourist attractions, which any other guide would focus on. I just wanted to let people share in what I enjoy when I am in these places. That alone is value. It's my people want to have the same experience as I have. And so he had to overcome his imposter syndrome that, what do I know? I just love to travel. I'm not an historian. I don't, I'm not even a professional travel agent, but I do have a passion and I love to let people share in my enthusiasm about Europe and about these places that I visit. And I was like, you know what? That is so relatable. That's how I make my TV show. It's like, I am discovering people and stories. And the reason that I make my TV show is that I want to let other people share in my discoveries. And people relate to that and resonate. That resonates with my audience. Almost all the feedback that I get is not, oh, that was so interesting to see another documentary about this or that place. No, it's always like, oh, I love that moment where you actually went there and cooked vegetarian meals with the sisters. And it's like this very personal approach that is still very rare on public television that people love to see and want to see more of. And I will always remember the trip that we did to Rome a couple of years ago, organized by Mountain Torek, where all the people that participated were from our community. And just being able for what was it, 5 days to hang out together, and I showed them Rome. What do I know? I actually know very little, and what I know, I usually have to look up on Wikipedia. But I do have my own experience of the city. I love Rome. And it's that passion, it's that enthusiasm that is much more important than to just have all the facts. That's why Mountain was there. He knows a lot and can tell stories that I cannot tell. But and even Mountain does that too in his show. Mountain, maybe you're listening to this. Maybe you should have a talk maybe in one of my podcasts. How you build up, you're kind of completely reinvented your business during Corona times. I was very impressed to see how Mountain did that by starting to do podcasts. He already did videos very, very often, very interesting, funny videos, usually with his two daughters also starring. And it was just lovely to see, to discover Rome through his eyes. But during Corona, of course, no more pilgrimages. So how are you going to survive if your core business is being a tour guide and organizing pilgrimages? Well, it's very simple. It's not very simple. It's genius. He started a podcast and did all sorts of videos and set up a Patreon channel. And then he would do these tipsy Thursdays or I don't know. What was it, a Thursday? I don't know. But anyway, so he would just sit down, have a drink at a bar somewhere in Rome, and then would tell his viewers about Rome. Or sometimes he would go for a walk and just go on a live tour of certain areas in Rome. And people loved it. And of course, you can watch so many documentaries and YouTube videos about Rome, but that's not the point. It's Mountain. I've traveled with this guy. He organized the trip to Assisi 5 years ago. And wow, now I can get I can continue to experience Rome through his eyes. And even though nobody can go to Rome, he brings Rome to us. That has value. I want to support that. I want to enable that. I want to have more of that. And that is, I think, how Mountain has not only survived, but has thrived. In terms of the quality of what he does and the reach of the stories that he tells, I don't think it's ever been bigger than this year. And I'm trying to learn from those examples. I'm trying to emulate that. So I was thinking, what can I add to the places that I visit? Why did people love, for instance, Catholic Insider, which was a podcast that I did back when you guys weren't even born yet, the dawn of podcasting. I was traveling and I was recording these sound-seeing tours. I would just visit places and tell people what I saw, what I felt, what I tasted, what I smelled. And it was that very personal first-person view or impression of these trips that people latched onto. That is what I would like to bring back. Or if I have to choose what to do when I don't have my TV job anymore, that's what I want to do. I want to bring people with me and help them look at the world through my eyes. And the other thing is, I know how to tell stories. And I love reading and learning about stories that will give context to the place that I'm visiting. Like, you can go to a beautiful church in Rome, but what good is that? There are thousands of beautiful churches in and around Rome. So what makes this place special and interesting? It's the story related to this building. And it's when you go back in time and you hear about this person who actually lived here and the bones are still there. That's him or that's her. And you've told a relatable, fascinating story that is inspiring. All of a sudden, that whole trip will get so much more depth and so much more value. And that's what I can do. That's what I want to do, is tell these stories and tell them visually. But then why not do what Rick Steves did and just make these programs, give them away, put them on YouTube, put them anywhere, let people, let broadcasting companies air them. I don't care. And then what I do is I invite people, come along with me, have these adventures with me, discover all these countries with me. And that could probably sustain me. So I could do all the rest just because I love having fun doing it. I love making TV shows. But if I can somehow make sure that I don't have to earn my wages by making TV shows, but I can do that in a different way. And that is what Rick Steves does. It's like, it's all about the trips that he does, that he organizes. Now, I'm not a very good organizer. I'm actually quite disorganized, but you can always do something with what I did with Mountain, you know, let someone who's very good at that organize the material part of it, physical part. People have to sleep, people have to eat. Let me be the storyteller. And I don't know. And not just trips. I'm not just talking about tourist destination. Actually, I wouldn't be that interested in that. But what I would like to do is to bring people along on a pilgrimage. Now, Mountain, if you're listening, I'm not going to be any competition for you. I'm not talking about traditional pilgrimages. But more like, I want to take you on a journey where you can learn something about yourself, about your vocation, about your place in life. Because I happen to be also a pastor. And so it's my job to help people figure out where to go in life. And I've learned myself, for instance, by going on a pilgrimage myself to Lourdes or to Rome or to Santiago, how much the journey itself can give you pointers as to what you should do, will help you think on who you are right now and what God wants you to be. There is something about traveling that changes you if you make it more than just a tourist trip. That is, you see, so this one interview made me think about so many possibilities, and especially this disconnect between the TV shows or the videos that I make and the financial part of it, the income part. If I can do the videos, and because I love doing it, and because I love to let people see what I see, just as I did with the Catholic Insider with the audio, but I don't have to, you know, run from deadline to deadline and try to stay relevant for Dutch TV. If I can get rid of all that, I think the whole process will become so much more enjoyable. And then if I can add to that a pastoral activity, which leading a pilgrimage is a pastoral activity, and it's fitting for a priest to do that kind of work, I will combine the best of both worlds. I can be a pastor. I can help people with their vocation in life, with what God wants, help maybe also help heal people. That's an important aspect of the ministry in Lourdes, always help people find where they're hurting and help them to heal from that. I'm not doing that. God is doing that through the intercession of the Virgin Mary. But still, you're a facilitator of that. I can combine it with making programs, traveling, meeting people, telling stories. There is so much that I enjoy doing. And I think that will be a game changer if I can somehow bring that all together. And I'm so confident that if I would do that, that it would work. Because I've seen it for years and years and years that I've done this podcasting. I've seen how it resonates with people because it's my experience. It's my enthusiasm. It's my passion that is infectious for other people. And that in turn gives me a lot of energy to continue bringing people along, either virtually through the videos and the podcasts that I make, or in real life, and maybe a combination thereof. So just wanted to share that with you before I started the show. And since we're already 20 minutes into the show, let's take a look at the kitchen. Just look at the kitchen. So you know that one of the people that lives here in the rectory in Wageningen is Luigi. Luigi is from the north of Italy, and he is a great cook. Now, I always thought that everybody who lives in Italy is a great cook because they're from Italy. But apparently, from what I've heard, Luigi has gotten the bug of cooking here, since he's here. And of course, when la mamma is no longer cooking, you have to do it yourself. And, well, he definitely inherited the cooking gene from his mother and probably also la nonna, the grandmother, because he is a really good cook. He already prepared some pastas, and I'm like, wow, this is so much better than anything I've tasted before, including some Italian restaurants. And I always ask him for the recipe, and it never fails to impress me how simple it is. It's always about fresh, good quality ingredients, but only a few. And it's all about the timing. It's all about, you know, keeping things simple. And that to me is what I like about the Italian kitchen. It's fresh, it's simple, and it's pure. And it's not overloaded like the kind of Americanized Italian food that you would eat at a chain restaurant or something like that, like Olive's Garden, where at one I remember that I went there once, and I love American food. The portion sizes are a little bit intimidating, but the food is always good. I mean, I can't remember one single time that we went to a restaurant and it wasn't, you know, delicious, but it's also very loaded. And we went to Olive Garden and I heard it was like an Italian restaurant. So I ordered this pasta con vongole. So it's pasta spaghetti with what I thought was just going to be scallops or something like that, or just some, you know, seafood. And then after a while, they bring me this huge plate, and the diameter was already impressive, but then it was not a flat plate, but it had an indentation. So they had this mountain of pasta, and you could tell that it was super rich. So it had shrimp in it, but not just small, you know, modest European shrimp, but these big, fat American shrimp from outer space. And it had mushrooms and cream and herbs, and the whole thing was steaming. And it was, you take one bite and you're full. Like, oh my gosh. And I remember that I couldn't finish the plate, and that the people that I was with, I don't even remember, maybe it was with Captain Jeff, they said, well, you can just ask for a doggy bag and it'll just, and you can eat it tomorrow. And like, for real? I was always, you know, accustomed to, if it's to either you eat it all because you don't want to insult the cook, or, well, they throw it away. But more than half of my plate was put in a doggy bag because it was just so rich. And so incredibly, it was delicious, but it was so much. And you take a bite and you don't even know what you're tasting. Like, there is like an explosion of all sorts of different flavors. It's just too much. It's like ordering a medium-sized Coke in a McDonald's in the US. And you get like a gallon of Coke. I mean, that would be, in the Netherlands, not even a big or a super-sized Coke. If you order a big size Coke in the Netherlands, that's actually the small Coke in the US. So with everything, it's just too much. And what I love about the Italian kitchen is it has what it needs to have, and that's it. Just taste. Don't try to bombard your taste buds with too much. You can't process it. You can't even finish your plate. It's just enough. It's like a pasta. It's never meant to be a full meal. It's always a starter, almost. It's like the primo corso. And then you eat something very light. You're not going to eat like fries and a big steak. No. If you order like a secondo in Italy, it's always a little bit of meat or a little bit of fish. And it's almost like it wouldn't be enough as a meal. But because you already had your antipasti, you already had a bit of bread, you already had the pasta, and it's usually not much, the pasta. Add a salad to that and a little bit of meat, and you've tasted so much in the course of one meal, but you're not knocked out for the rest of the day. So, Luigi has been really good at helping me learn this simple way of cooking. And so the other day, yesterday, he was in the kitchen and I could tell that he was going to make something in the oven. He had flour on the kitchen table and he added yeast and then yogurt, which was a bit puzzling. I was like, wow, I've never seen someone make dough with yogurt. And then I was cooking something myself, so after a while I saw him putting something in the oven, and it was a flattened square of what looked like flatbread or something like that. And then after 20 minutes he took it out again and added olive oil on top of it. And I asked, well, what are you making? Well, I'm making focaccia. And I was like, I want to learn this. And at the dinner, I think I had cooked an Indonesian meal, nasi, which couldn't be further away from the Italian kitchen. But I thought we were going to be the three of us eating that. But Father Henry had a Zoom meeting and he was hungry and probably didn't have time to eat, kind of what I see almost every day. Father Henry works too hard, really. So I gave him some of the rice. So we had barely enough for the three of us, but then we had this focaccia bread, so I could taste that, and it was so fluffy and so nice. It's very simple, and you could add a little bit of, eat it with some cheese and then drink a glass of wine. We kind of skipped a wine, but nevertheless, my ideal end of the meal would be have a bit of focaccia with some French cheese and a good glass of red wine. So I asked him, how do you make this? I want to learn how to make this. He said, it's so simple. First of all, you take flour. Here's the recipe. Just take flour. Just nothing is measured. You know, you just wing it. To the flour, you add a half a cube of yeast. You should not use the powdered yeast, the dry yeast. That's not going to work. You have to use the more squishy yeast that the bakers use. You can probably get that at your local bakery. And they usually come in these, you know, square inches of like a tiny cube. You take half of that. You kind of divide that over the flour, and then you add some yogurt. He said it's not necessary, but you could also use milk. And I was like, do you put any eggs in there or salt? No, no, no. Just flour, yeast, and a bit of yogurt. I used, full fat yogurt. And then he kneads that into a dough. And then he said, you know, the thing is, now the secret of good focaccia is that it rises and it becomes fluffy. And the way you did, and he showed me a trick. He said, you put the oven on very low temperature, like about a little bit warmer than room temperature. And you leave it in there for about half an hour. The heat, the warmth of the oven will quicken the rising process. And so after about half an hour, he said you could even put it in for an hour. The more you let it in, the more fluffier it gets. After that, you put the oven on 220 degrees Celsius. Let me look that up for you. Is Fahrenheit? That would be 428 degrees Fahrenheit. approximately. So let's say 420 Fahrenheit. And then you leave it, you let it bake for about 15 to 20 minutes. Just keep an eye on it. As soon as the... Oh, one more thing. Before you put it in the oven, when it still, you know, needs to rise, you can also sprinkle like rock salt over it. So these salt crystals, thick salt crystals. You don't never put the salt inside the dough because it will stop the leavening process. Because of course yeast is living, and if you put salt in it, it will, you know, it will die. It won't be as fluffy. But instead you put the salt on top of the bread. And then one thing that he didn't do, but he said you could do that also, is use what was it? I'm not good with herbs. Not thyme. Not. Oh gosh, what do you put on focaccia? Focaccia herbs. You can probably just use any herbs. Rosmarin, that's it. So you can sprinkle rosemarin, is that how you call it? Over the bread, which will give it an extra bite. Then after about 20 minutes, when the top starts to become golden, you take it out of the oven again, and then you actually put olive oil with a brush on the top layer of the bread, and you put it in until it becomes really crispy. That's it. That's how easy it is. A lot, you know, just played by, not by ear, but by eye. Just look at, does it look good? And it probably will taste good. And in this case, it was just the most wonderful fluffy bread, and so much better than anything you could get from a bakery, unless you have a Italian baker who makes it fresh for you. But this was so simple and so yummy and costs almost nothing. It's just a bit of flour, a bit of yeast, a bit of yogurt. It's so simple. But today, half of the bread was still left over. You could still eat it the next day. It's a whole lot of food for almost nothing, and it tastes so good. That is my recipe for today. Let me know on the Discord server if you've ever made focaccia bread, or if you want to try it out based on this recipe, please post a photo, or otherwise we will not believe you. Just kidding. What I learned on the internet. Oh, I saw such an amazing TikTok video. You know that on Monday we're going to start the renovation of my future home. Tomorrow, Saturday, I'm recording this on Friday evening. Saturday will be the first, is it the first day? No, April has 31 days. So on Sunday will be the 1st of May. Am I correct? Let me look at the calendar. No, it's tomorrow. What am I saying? Yeah. Saturday is the 1st of May. Tomorrow will be the first day that I officially am an inhabitant of Bennekom. And on Monday, we're going to start the renovation. Now, the choices, choices, choices. Of course, we need to paint everything. It needs new floors. But now is my chance to turn this into a home that fits me. And I've told you last week that I've, in the walk, that I saved up for this. And that one of the titles that I put on the funds that I had in the bank was to create my hobbit home. And I've always had this dream, well, what if I could create something that actually looks like Bag End? But how do you do that? Is it even possible? My home is a house that was built in the 50s. That was right after the war. People didn't have much money. The house itself is not pretty on the outside. It's built in a very simple style. It's spacious, but everything is square and kind of industrial looking. Is it even possible to give this a hobbit atmosphere? Well, I didn't believe that was possible, but now this TikTok video has given me hope. And the video was posted by Scott Christian Sava, who has an IMDb entry because I think he makes animated movies. But he also describes himself as a part-time hobbit. And he posted this amazing TikTok video where he shows you how a room that is just a hideous room, like very much like you see in almost any house with lots of children, where there is like a lot of everything is white and it's got gray floors, carpet too thick, but already, you know, too many, it's too old, so it's there are a lot of patch anyway, it looks ugly. And then he had so many shelves with all sorts of geek stuff. But it looked like basically a kid's room. And it was so messy. And everything was just of the ugly lamps on the ceiling, you know, with these just white bulbs, no atmosphere whatsoever. It was just hideous. And then he shows you what he has turned it into, or actually with the help of a few friends he made. And it looks literally like a set, a movie set from The Shire. And you could tell that it is just a modern house. Everything is square. But so he created this beautiful round door, and all the windows have now circular wood around it. And he shows all sorts of tricks on how you can make your own hobbit furniture. I think it must have cost him probably a year to make that. But what is lovely is he gives you photos of the making of. So he shows you, it's TikTok, so it's all vertical. And yeah, I wish he would have filmed much more. Maybe I can find a place where he posts more pictures. But already from what I can tell, this is not so hard. I cannot do it, but someone who has a little aptitude with woodwork could probably replicate this. So now I'm thinking, what if my living room could look like that? It's now or never. Now, of course, I'm renting this house, you know, and my rent is for 2 years. And then maybe it gets renewed. But there is also a possibility, at least theoretical, that after 2 years I have to move again. So everything I install has to be, I need to be able to remove it as well. Because normally if you rent, you have to leave it as the way you found it. But I'm thinking this has to be possible. It has to be possible to create something. And maybe with, you know, do the same, or I don't know. I need someone to design this, but now I can do it. And yes, it will be more expensive than just, you know, painting the walls and the ceiling. But if I don't do it now, it will never happen, and I may always regret it. Now I have a chance to make it look really like a hobbit hole. And I'm so tempted. But the fact that I saw this TikTok video where you see the end result, I'm going to post again the link in the show notes. So if you go to, I'll also post it on Patreon. I usually have show notes also on the website, but they're invisible because the people that are not supporting me through Patreon get like a secret feed. But no, I'll also include the link to the TikTok video on Patreon. So just go to your account and to the post that belongs to this audio file. And you can look for yourself. I'm not an expert, but I'm going to show this to Henk, who actually has worked in construction, has been trained in that. And his father is a carpenter. And I'm just going to ask him, do you know how we can realize this? I'm not saying that you have to do this, but if I would have the budget for this, can we make this? Or not exactly that, because the house is very different, but something in this style. Can we do this? Can we try this? I think this could be a fantastic project. I think it's going to be amazing, let alone, you know, using that for my videos. Oh, my goodness. Now that we get like a Lord of the Rings Middle Earth series on Amazon, which is going to be hopefully high profile, I need a set for that. And I don't want it to be green screen. Maybe it's just a pipe dream, but man, I was looking at that and I was like, finally someone did what I've been wanting to do for 10 years. And now I may actually be able to pull it off. If only.
I'm quite keen on comic books, especially the ones about superheroes. I find the whole mythology surrounding superheroes fascinating.
You ever try these comics?
No.
You know something?
No, what?
You read too many comic books.
Well, in this segment, the jingle is not exactly what it should be, because this is about superheroes, etc. But this is where I want to have another moment where I can talk about movies or animated series or whatever, superhero stuff. Oh, by the way, speaking of superheroes, last week I did my review of the first season of The Falcon and the Winter Soldier. There is now a making-of video on Disney Plus, which I'm going to watch after I'm done recording this. I'm looking forward to that. And I wonder if we're going to hear about this plot line that has been changed. We now have... This was one of my theories, why the first season was so-so at times. You know, it was a lot to enjoy, but also story-wise, it's not the best. It's certainly not on par with The Mandalorian. But that may actually be partially because they had to completely redo the storyline after they already filmed principal photography. And so they had to use all sorts of tricks to get rid of a storyline that involved a pandemic, which was caused by some evil dude in an Asian country. You can imagine the fallout that would have had they gone with this storyline. So maybe that is why the story of the first season feels a little bit contrived and forced at times. So the director actually has admitted that there was a storyline that they had to get rid of, but he doesn't really tell us explicitly what it was. But at least it's good to know that the fan theories have a basis. And yes, they had to change the story. So my guess is that the theories are actually correct. That's not what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about a movie that I saw. Was it yesterday? No, it was the day before yesterday. It was a long movie. So Eric, the seminarian, comes up to my room before dinner and he says, you know, would you like to watch a movie together with the group tonight? I'm saying, sure. Of course, I also watch movies here on my widescreen monitor. So it's not that I'm craving to watch a movie. But yeah, but I'm thinking Father Henry has this tiny little 4x3 television. I hope we're not going to watch it on that television, because it's been 20 years since I watched something on a television that small. But no. There was a projector that was no longer in use by the parish, but we would take a picture of a painting of the wall and then just project it on a white wall in Father Henry's living room. And if I was interested in looking at his DVD collection. So I did, and again, I was impressed by Eric's interest in all sorts of geeky movies that I thought I was the only person working for this diocese that would be into those movies. I'm talking about The Matrix and Crouching Tiger and even Final Fantasy VII. What else was there? Godzilla. Was there Godzilla? I don't remember. Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, all the good stuff. But of course, I wanted to see a movie that I hadn't seen before. And that was tricky because I've seen so many of those movies already. And then we ended up watching a movie based on a novel, the second novel ever written by Stephen King, the master of horror, of course, and suspense. Now, I'm not a big Stephen King reader. I do enjoy some of the stories, the short stories that I've read. And I try to read The Dark Tower. And, well, you know, if you've been listening to me for a while, I really couldn't get through the first book. And then I saw the movie, and that was not so good either. Plus, in the movie, they kind of spoil the entire ending and what's going on. So you know, for me, the motivation to keep reading that was zero. And then a good friend of mine, John Domick, he actually read a second book. And he, too, had such a hard time getting into the story. So he gave up after his second book. And, you know, John is usually reading so much more. He's gotten way more persistence than I have. So, I mean, he read, like, gosh, the first book by Sanderson about the King something, King Bull. It's like a 600-page book. But anyway, so John said, I'm not going to continue this. So I gave up after the first book. Eric read the entire Dark Tower series. That is so much to read. And it turns out this story, of which we saw the movie, ties into this Dark Tower universe. I don't understand how, because the first movie kind of looked like a post-apocalyptic Western, and it's kind of weird. But there is this character, I think it's the priest. There's a Catholic priest in this story. And he ends up in the Dark Tower series. I don't know how, but I was intrigued. Now, the story is called Salem's Lot. And this book has been turned into movies and TV series, I think, three times now. And there's been a horrible sequel to the story as well, which is not very good. This was the 2004 TV series, which I didn't know. We were watching this movie, and it was long. Oh, my. We started watching right after dinner, and then we finished at midnight. I was like, wow, I did not expect this movie to be like 3.5 hours long. Turns out this was actually a two-part television series, and the DVD just showed everything in sequence. So I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe they made such a long movie based on a relatively short book. But it tells the story of a journalist or a writer who goes back to the town where he grew up, Salem. And at first, he tells people that it is to kind of narrate the story of his youth. And then there's this strange house that looks a little bit like a Hitchcock house from... what was that? Anyway, this spooky house on top of a hill. And according to people, there are, you know... Something there is not quite right, and the turns out the writer witnessed a murder and some supernatural events as a kid in that house by accident, and he's been traumatized for the rest of his life, and now he wants to go back and figure out what's going on. Now, I will spare you the details of the story. It is it's not very scary. I expected something a little bit more, I don't know, like with more jump scares. Thankfully, that wasn't the case, because I don't like jump scares. I don't like horror as a genre, because I'm just too much of a chicken. But I do like a good Stephen King story. So thankfully for me, this was perhaps the least horrific version of the story. But it was still entertaining. You can tell that they are trying to cram in a lot of details, that the book itself has a gazillion characters. And even though they try to weed some of them out here and simplify the story, it was still a lot. And some of these scenes and events are a bit like they feel like a setup, but there's never a payoff. And it's just because they wanted to do justice to the book, I guess. It doesn't always work. I think a little bit more discipline, make a shorter version. Maybe if this would be cut down to 2 hours, it would have worked. But that was right now, it was just too much in this story. But what was also interesting is that it features so many well-known actors. Like all the main characters, I knew them from other series. And I was constantly like, I know this guy. I know this. What's his name? Oh, my gosh. Oh, it's Rob Lowe from The West Wing and from Parks and Recreation. This is from 2004, so that's before he did The West Wing and before he got, you know, and he was very well known for The West Wing and also for his role in Parks and Rec. But this was before that. He's not the best fit for this role, but, you know, he does a decent job. And then there's this other character, and he plays a teacher, an English teacher, who used to be the teacher of this journalist, of this writer, but is pretty critical about the work that Rob Lowe's character has written after leaving school. And the actor who plays him is Andre Brouwer. I'm not sure how to pronounce that name. And I was like, I know this guy. He's been in so many TV series. Turns out he was in House several times and also in Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which I've never seen. But apparently he had a recurring role for many, many episodes. And then he's played a ton of other roles for decades. So it's just one of those phases like, I know this guy. Where do I know him from? And then you look it up on IMDb and you're like, oh, he's always a secondary character. But he did a great job. Then you have Donald Sutherland, who, of course, is so recognizable and is in so many different movies, mostly. And he plays a very, very evil guy in this. But he looks exactly the same as the president in The Hunger Games. He's got the same, he's got this beautiful beard, President Snow. And here he looks identical. So I was like, wait, is this the same guy as in Hunger Games? No. It's just the same actor playing a different role. But he's got the same beard. Yeah. Live with it. Deal with it. So it was funny to see. And it kind of breaks the immersion because you're like, oh, man, that's another actor that I know so well. And then you had the priest, the Catholic priest, who's played by James Cromwell. And James Cromwell is also one of those faces that you've seen so many times. He plays in so many movies. Like, he plays a role in The Green Mile. He's in L.A. Confidential. Let me go through the list here. Also, a ton of series that I've never heard of. He's in Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom as Benjamin Lockwood. He is... Ow, I didn't know that. He plays a cardinal in The Young Pope, of which I still have to do a review, but I'm kind of reluctant because I tried to watch the first episode of the series, and I hope it's getting better because I did not like it at all. It was cringeworthy TV, but maybe it'll get better. I'll give it one more episode. He also plays Philip Bauer in 24, the TV series. He's Captain Stacy in Spider-Man 3. He plays Prince Philip in The Queen. I did not know that. He also plays a cardinal in a mini TV series based on the life of John Paul II. Again, I did not know that. He's Dr. Alfred Lanning in iRobot, of course. And then he is also President Newman in The West Wing. Huh. Wow. Okay. And, of course, he's Dr. Cochrane in Star Trek Enterprise, which to me was a role that did not fit him at all. But anyway, he's been in Star Trek. So, and then that's not all. The main bad guy is Rutger Hauer, who died last year. And we all know him from Blade Runner, of course. And he plays a demonic character, and he does it with so much. His role is too small for such a big name. But every scene he is in is so intense. He's so menacing. Whoa, amazing. Very much the same intensity that you see in Blade Runner. I need to rewatch Blade Runner. It's just one of those movies I can watch over and over and over again. And then you've got Samantha Mathis, who plays the girlfriend, you could say the love interest of the main character. And she also features in another series based on the work of Stephen King, Under the Dome, which I think had two or three seasons. So she's a recurring character on that show as well. All in all, what did I think of the story? It was long, but it was entertaining. And at the end, once I saw it, I I listened to a podcast from the Now Playing podcast. They did a whole series on all the different versions of Salem's Lot. And it was interesting to listen to that because they give a lot of background information on how the movie got made or the series got made and what they think of it. And often helps me also to reconstruct the story. And there are always elements that I did not understand or didn't really get. Like the ending is a little bit like, huh? Wait a minute, where are they now? Oh, that harkens back to the beginning of the movie, but I didn't understand the beginning of the movie. And then I listen to the podcast and look, oh, now I get it. Now all the pieces fit together. So sometimes podcasts really help me to understand a movie. Sometimes I need a little bit of help.
The humanoid must not escape.
And before I wrap up the show with the liturgy segment, a brief update on the video games that I play and the video games that I am planning to play. So I'm still dabbling around in Valheim, and I finished my boathouse. I'm so proud of it. Oh, it's gorgeous. I love it. And I am going to record a video because I've made a video, a vlog about my adventures in Valheim when the game just came out. And I had no experience whatsoever. So those are pretty boring. But now I have built this huge house and it took me 2 months to build it. And I just want to give people a tour. And I didn't even come up with the house myself. I copied it from a YouTube video. But I'm proud of the fact that I puzzled together the entire house just based on a very short 2 minute video that I just watched frame by frame. I already told you that story. But I want to show you my house because I'm so proud of it. I wish I could have a house like that in real life because it's so amazing. But this game really made me more ambitious when it comes to, you know, my future home. This is feasible. I know how to build it in Valheim. I just need a carpenter to help me realize it in real life. So, the other game that I am hoping to play very soon, I won't be able to stream it for two reasons. First of all, Wi-Fi here is still totally down the drain, but also the game continues a ton of licensed music, and it's unfortunately no longer allowed to stream video games with that copyrighted music on YouTube, Facebook, or Twitch. Even Twitch has now really tightened the reins when it comes to using copyrighted music. So, and I don't want to play this game with the music off, which I've done in the past with some other games, like Battlefront 2. I turn the music off, but the music, especially when it's about this game, needs the music for the impact to be good enough. I'm talking about the newest Star Wars game, Jedi Fallen Order. I got this from one of our listeners for my birthday. And this is one of those games that when it came out, I was like, I'll wait until the price goes down because these games are expensive. And I still have such a big backlog of other games that I want to play. I can wait. I will wait. And so now I got this game for my birthday and I can't wait to play it. From what I've heard of it, it is so good. And I am really, I'm, there's a hole in my soul when it comes to Star Wars. Mandalorian is finished. We're still waiting for the Bad Batch, which will start on May the 4th. But even that is just going to be a few episodes. Short episodes, no doubt. I need more Star Wars storytelling. So I'm looking forward to enjoying Jedi Fallen Order. What I may do is, Maybe what I could do, now that I think of it, I could record the gameplay and then do like a narration of the game. Just show short clips, and then of course I can turn off the music and write about my adventures and then narrate that in a voiceover. That may be a good way to let people share in this adventure. Let me think. I don't have much time, and I still have three episodes that I have to edit about my trip to Compostela, to Santiago, which will probably take most of my time in the upcoming weeks. But anyway, I'll let you know what I do with it. And with that, it is time for the liturgy segment. I'm just going to briefly touch upon something that I will probably talk about at length in future episodes of this podcast, and that is liturgy renewal. Now, this is something that the church has always done, right? Liturgy, the way we celebrate it today, is very different from the type of liturgy that my parents grew up with. That tradition, the Tridentine Mass or Latin Mass, which is sometimes called, that's not correct, because the current liturgy can also be celebrated fully in Latin and facing east. But anyway, that tradition is also was a successor to another liturgy, and so a lot of the elements that we have in current day liturgy actually harken back to the first centuries, the documents that we found about liturgical practices in the early church. So, you know, renewal is always something. You can't do that without taking from the past what you want to bring into the future. And at the same time, liturgy is always in movement, because we are. Our language changes, our expressions changes, our cultures are different. And so liturgy is always this interaction between the things that are unmovable, the faith itself, God, who does not change, but our expressions of our faith and our ways of worshiping do change. And it's a good thing that it's just evolving. It's a liturgy is a language, ultimately, if you look at it. Just like our language changes throughout the ages, so does liturgy. Right now, there's, of course, this whole movement, like, for instance, around the rebuilt parish. This is an American parish where that was almost dead. And then a priest and I think a pastoral assistant, they were willing to completely rethink the way they did church, to say it irreverently. And they realized that what we're doing is just maintenance. We're just doing old stuff for old people the way we have always done it. But what we don't do is to make people disciples. And the seed of renewal is to go back to our original mission as a church, and that is to go to the ends of the world, baptize people in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teach them about the gospel. We've forgotten to do that. In many of our activities in the parishes is just, you know, keeping people entertained. we put our energy and our time into a lot of activities that are just social in nature and have actually don't help people to grow closer to Jesus. And so rebuilt, this whole method, it's not really a method, it's more an experience that they share with the rest of the world, is based on, you know, what if we refocus on making people disciples of Jesus? And what if we, instead of doing what we've always done, just look at, does it produce fruit? And if not, shouldn't we change? And so they made a lot of changes to the way they celebrate liturgy. And the results were overwhelming. It's a flourishing parish with lots and lots of new parishioners, with a very healthy age pyramid where lots of young people and families coming there as well. And then you have also the ministry of James Mallon, Father James Mallon, a Canadian priest who did something similar. His approach is when God, what was it? When God renovated, divine renovation in English, and it's a slightly different style, a different approach, but the same fundamental insight that if you want to renew the church, you have to go back to the core of the gospel and the core of the mission of the church, which is to make disciples and to help people do what Jesus did. And if something that you do is not conducive to that, then you should stop doing it. So both these priests are advocating a radical change of the approach, because it no longer works what we've been doing. It doesn't mean that it becomes heterodox, or, you know, that you lose, that you change the substance of the faith. No, it's all about getting rid of all the onion layers that are obfuscating what the Catholic faith is truly about. But, of course, there's also the question of style. And so here in the parish of Wageningen, they're also thinking about, well, what can we learn from these two books, from these two authors and their experiences? And so we are thinking about, or we, I say we because I live here, but Father Henry is thinking about organizing a mass every month that is really focused on the new people. It should be evangelizing, should be missionary. And so let's try something else. Let's try something that we haven't tried before, including maybe changing the style of the liturgy. Now, we're still in this phase of reconnaissance. Let's see what they do over there. Let's see what we can learn from it. So we had a meeting, and I said, well, maybe we should just take a look at the online registrations of those masses there and see if that's something that we can learn from. So I watched one of those masses from the rebuilt parish, and I have mixed feelings about it. I can definitely see the enthusiasm, and what struck me was how professional everything looked. So much better than anything I've seen in any Catholic church. Like the lights, the cameras, microphones, sound, the songs, the music. Man, it looked like I was watching like a big TV show, including like special effects with spotlights on the priests and everything. And it was, but that was also for me the thing that bothered me. And that was not my style. It felt so much like what I see in every evangelical church. It was basically a rock concert. And then all of a sudden there's this priest starting mass, but it felt so incongruent. And such a divide between the style of music and then the liturgy and the forms of liturgy that it were trying to combine with that music. And also, it was not just the music, it was also the performance of the music. There's an entire band standing there with drums and electric guitars and multiple singers with microphones, and everyone has its own spotlight. And it feels so much like a TV show, like America's Got Talent or something like that, like Catholic Church's Got Talent. And the talent is there. It's great quality. The songs are very catchy. But it felt so different from the liturgy that was embedded in there. And so I was like, I can see what they're trying to do. I think that it works for that particular community. But I don't think this is a one-size-fits-all solution for every parish. What I felt was missing was the beauty of the liturgical tradition from centuries old. And I've seen, when I did my streaming masses in Hochlanderveen from St. Joseph's Church, that you can also celebrate a liturgy that is both very geeky, very modern in its translation of the faith during the homily, but it's very classic in its expressions. We did a lot of masses just with Gregorian chants. That was also, we didn't have a choice. We couldn't afford music. So you sing what everybody recognizes, something that is universal, and that's Gregorian chant. But a lot of people enjoyed that. A lot of young people came to church because we did so much with Latin chant, because there was a certain reverence during the liturgy. It wasn't a show. So I'm kind of torn, and I think I'll have to, you know, give it some more thought. And I think it's the purpose of rebuild and God, divine renovation is not to give you a prescription. Do this and you will thrive, but it's to show you this. This is how we changed our way of doing. Now you go ask the Holy Spirit what He would want to change in your church. But I would say definitely for the Dutch situation, we need to find forms that may include a little bit more of our very rich liturgical tradition that we have in the Netherlands. And in that respect, the situation here in Europe is very different from the US. I've been to a lot of parishes in the US where the singing was, so 70s. Whereas in our churches, even in the ones that are barely attracting any people anymore, we still have, you know, classical music, we've got organ, Latin. None of that is gone. It's watered down. And there are parishes where it's really subpar what they do musically, liturgically. But there are also a lot of parishes where, you know what, it still feels like Catholic liturgy and you recognize it. Whether you go to Rome or to the Netherlands, it's kind of, you feel at home. Whereas with the liturgy that I saw in that parish of the rebuilt project, I was like, wow, this does not feel like a Catholic church. I can appreciate it for what it is. I can see the quality of what they do, but it's not my liturgy. I would not like to have this every week as a priest, but even as a parishioner, this is just, it's too much. Maybe I need to be an American to appreciate it fully. Anyway, that's what I wanted to share with you. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your support. I'll be back. See you later.